Thursday, April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, White House rivals deal blows to the frontrunners on the road to the White House. A backlog of cases mires Europe's deportation of migrants.
These women, they fight hard, they play hard, they give as much effort and time into their dreams and their ambitions and their passions as the men do.
Equal pay is kicked around on the soccer field. Also ahead, a country music icon has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Tuesday was a good day for U.S. presidential challengers. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz and Vermont Democrat Senator Bernie Sanders each won their respective primary elections in the upper Midwest state of Wisconsin. Jeffrey Skelling, associate editor of the Sabato Crystal Ball, a publication of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, told VOA's Victor Beatty, for Trump, that's Donald, that is, the path to securing the Republican Party's presidential nomination before the national convention in Cleveland in July has narrowed.
He was pretty borderline to get to 1,237 delegates, even if you were sort of gaming it out and giving him a statewide victory in Wisconsin and thus most of the delegates from the Badger State. Now, he's basically in a position where if he wants to get a majority, he's either going to have to do even better than maybe we could predict at this point in his home state of New York and also in California, or he is going to have to do as well as he can and then also maybe pick up some support from delegates who are technically unbound or were committed to other candidates or are now free. However, a complication in that process is that it appears that Marco Rubio is trying to hold on to his 173 delegates so that he can perhaps be something of a power broker at a convention and or prevent Trump from getting to a majority. The most important thing to really consider is that this has definitely raised the odds of a contested convention occurring. And we haven't had a contested convention, and by that I mean one that went beyond one ballot. And on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders looks to be getting a pretty decent victory. But the problem for Sanders at this point is delegate math, and he needs to win by this kind of number and then win by even more in some places. Sanders is really climbing up a steep hill, going ahead to a state like New York, which is incredibly diverse, especially around New York City, which will deliver a huge chunk of the vote. It will be difficult for Sanders to win in that environment.
Let's talk about the Republicans. We hear a lot of talk about a brokered or open convention. What does this all mean?
If the convention goes to a second ballot, suddenly over half of the delegates will be technically free agents, which is to say that the candidate that they were bound to by the vote that occurred in their state or territory will no longer apply to them, and it will be up to their personal individual feelings. And if you go beyond a second ballot, at that point, the vast majority of the delegates are essentially free agents at that point.
On the Democratic side, Senator Sanders, does his staying power mean something bad for Hillary Clinton for November?
I think part of that depends on who the Republicans end up nominating. If you look at Sanders supporters, most of them don't have negative feelings toward Clinton. Most of them would probably support her in November. But I do think the longer this carries on with Sanders very actively campaigning against Clinton, the more you do sow seeds for some possible intra-party turmoil and raise the possibility of more animosity.
After Wyoming, the candidates and the road to the White House run through New York, which holds a closed primary election April 19th. Well, dealing with taxes and the very wealthy has been one of the issues that candidates and voters have been considering, which leads us to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in Studio 22 to tell us what's trending online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So let me guess, what's the big story today?
Well, you nailed it. Like you said earlier, I think tax evasion takes a cake this week on social media. Today, it's about Pfizer, one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. The American company confirmed the termination of its merger with Dublin-based Allergan, and the merger was supposed to be worth $160 billion.
A huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. So this termination has to do with taxes.
Absolutely. Media reports say the termination comes after the Treasury Department set new tax regulations. So to break away from the agreement, Pfizer will pay Allergan $400 million.
Wow, that's astounding. What's the response been like online?
NPR's Facebook post had the most interesting responses, so this is the most liked reply so far. Let us all have a moment of solemn silence to reflect on Pfizer's fate. Consigning to pay taxes where they actually are headquartered and incorporated, we should all weep for poor Pfizer and its multi-billion dollar income not being able to escape basic obligations. Now, that reply is definitely sarcastic and received more than 1,000 likes. Another person wrote, the U.S. shouldn't be contributing incentives to American companies merging with foreign companies, thereby avoiding taxes and oversight and decreasing U.S. employment. Thank you, Mr. Obama.
Wow, so we can say the overall sentiment is supporting the Treasury Department's decision.
Exactly.
Wow. What else is trending?
The next trending topic is also relevant to healthcare. An independent regulator in the UK ruled Italian fashion brand Gucci's latest ad features a female model who looks too thin. When do we ever hear that? A woman who's too thin. The Advertising Standards Authority of Britain said the ad makes a female's waist look very small and her face gaunt. It went on to say such advertisement is irresponsible. The Guardian reported on this, and one of the most popular comments to that post is by a woman. Seriously, though, how can you afford food and Gucci at the same time? I want to elaborate. Gucci is a luxury brand and many of its products are very expensive. Other trending topics include the death of American country singer Merle Haggard at the age of 79 and a possible visit by Pope Francis to Greece to highlight the ongoing refugee crisis. Jim?
Well, I'm glad you brought up Merle Haggard because we'll hear a little bit more about that in our program. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. She tweets for our program on our official account at @VOA_IE. She has her very own at @GAbbyLee, and you can follow me on Twitter at @VOAStevenson. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. As Turkey prepared to receive a second group of migrants deported from Greece this week, European Union officials on Wednesday pledged there would be no automatic return for the migrants before they are given a chance to apply for asylum. The announcement follows angry protests by international human rights activists who have accused the EU of denying migrants the basic rights of refugees to seek asylum as the deportations began from Greek islands on Monday. VOA's Luis Ramirez has more from Turkey in a conversation earlier with International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Pretty significant development after an outcry by human rights groups who have been protesting on the Greek island of Lesbos for days now since the EU started to deport migrants. The rights groups complained that the migrants were not getting due process. They were not getting a fair chance to apply for asylum and that the process was not transparent. Well, on Wednesday, the EU made an announcement that it is now giving every migrant a chance to apply for asylum before a decision is made to return them to Turkey. What they're saying is that there will be no automatic returns. There was the accusation from human rights groups that the process was not giving people that chance, that they were simply being put on the boats. They say that's what happened on Monday when more than 200 migrants were returned as part of the first shipment. Now the migrants will have their cases heard individually. Their vulnerabilities will be taken into account. This is directly related to the charge that Turkey has a bad human rights record and that their fate is uncertain, that some of them might, their lives might be in danger by being returned to Turkey. This is the EU's way of addressing that concern of saying no one will be sent back if it looks like they will, if there is a chance that they will be killed, if their life is in danger in Turkey. And well, that is being implemented by about 70 staffers of the UN's asylum agency. And this is just in time for the next shipment of deportees, which is scheduled to take place on Friday. Those deportees being brought to Turkey, where I am now, and will be processed. On the Turkish side, there is a situation where you have them being whisked away out of public sight to camps far away from populated regions.
This sounds like a tremendous undertaking, though, Luis. There's so many people involved, and you mentioned there's only 70 people coming.
They're certainly looking to be, they are overwhelmed, in fact. About more than 3,000 estimated migrants being held in one camp alone on Lesbos. And the situation there is that the asylum office tells me they already have about 1,000 cases where people have expressed an interest in applying for asylum. They're going to be handling those, processing those at a rate of 50 per day. So that gives you a sense of just how big a backlog they're looking and how slow this process is going to be. Well, there are more than 3,000 waiting. It's going to take a while to clear them out.
VOA's Luis Ramirez in Turkey. Five of the top women's soccer players here in the United States have escalated a pay dispute with the U.S. Soccer Federation. That's the national governing body for the sport. The players filed a federal complaint last week with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, accusing U.S. soccer of wage discrimination because the federation pays significantly more to members of the men's national team than it does to the women. The dispute is the hot topic on this week's hashtag VOA show, and host Michael Lippin is here to tell us why. Michael?
Hi, Jim. Thank you very much. Well, the reason we focused on this dispute is because the U.S. women's national soccer team has a huge following in this country given its record of international success. That includes winning the World Cup in Canada last year. So when five of the team's top players launch a federal complaint against a body as powerful as the U.S. Soccer Federation, soccer fans take notice. Now, many soccer fans in this country support the women's demands for higher pay, and they're showing that support with a social media campaign using the hashtag #EqualPlayEqualPay. Now, we had two guests in the studio for the show. One of them was Washington-based sports attorney David Larkin, and the other, my personal favorite, was the women's national team former goalkeeper Brianna Scurry, who helped to win the World Cup for the U.S. back in 1999. Now, I asked Scurry what she thinks of critics who say the men's team should be paid more because the men play at a higher level of skill and intensity than the women.
I understand that argument and I appreciate it, and there's always going to be differences of opinion, but these women, they fight hard, they play hard, they give as much effort and time into their dreams and their ambitions and their passions as the men do. And the women's national team, it's no easy task to win 4 Olympic gold medals and 3 world championships over a 25-year period. It's just an amazing show of dominance. And these women are fantastic, and I'm honored to be able to say I've played with some of them and that I'm in the same sisterhood as they are. But I understand other people's issues with it, but there really is no grounds for that. We are as comparable, and we are as talented as the men are.
Well, David, you know, the U.S. Soccer Federation does make a case that the men's team is pulling in more revenue over a period of time. How do you think that argument will help them in this dispute with the U.S. women's players?
Well, I think the case law suggests that in these instances, what you're allowed to do in terms of paying people disparate amounts is that you're allowed to look at the market forces, okay? So courts, at least historically that we can find, are going to allow the market to dictate the level of pay. The question, though, I think, is one I kind of see more globally. And that is that across the world, soccer players, both men and women, are victimized by the current setup of world soccer, whether it be FIFA, the member associations, the confederations.
Can you give some examples of other countries?
Sure. We've got some players. For example, Zahir Balounis was trapped in Qatar. It was a player that was held against his will, and it took Human Rights Watch and an array of coalition, including us, to get him out. FIFA was nowhere to be found. I've seen players victimized, players who aren't paid, players who are beaten up. This happens all over the world. And what's so illustrative about this case to me is the idea that the best women players in the entire world are still fighting for equality. It's absurd that we're here. I understand the position of U.S. soccer, but it's my understanding that they have $93 million in the bank. If that is the case, there's absolutely no excuse for them not to pay equally to the women.
Well, the U.S. Soccer Federation says it is willing to discuss wages for the women's team as part of continuing negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement. The federation also stresses the role it has played in promoting the growth of women's soccer in the United States. Well, for more of our conversation, you can watch the full show on the hashtag VOA Facebook page. Just look for the featured video on the left-hand side of that page. And just a personal note to say that I was super excited to meet a member of that World Cup winning team in 1999. I remember watching that final. Scurry saved a penalty in that shootout. It was amazing.
It was. And in fact, I was there. I covered the 99 tournament.
Lucky so you.
Yes, I have fond memories. Thank you so much, Michael. And be sure to check out hashtag on our VOA Facebook page. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Country music great Merle Haggard has died. He passed away at his home in California on his 79th birthday Wednesday. VOA's David Byrd spoke with Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, Tennessee, about the life and legacy of Merle Haggard.
One of the legends of country music, one of the pillars of country music, Merle Haggard passed away, ironically, on his 79th birthday. Merle is one of those people that people point to as if I could be like him, I would be satisfied with my career. What was his contribution, and what do you think his legacy will be?
Merle was one of the greats of country music. It's hard to sum up his achievement in the field, but he was a songwriter. He was a performer. He was a musician. He stood shoulder to shoulder with the people we think of as the greats of the genre, people like Hank Williams, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Johnny Cash. But he really embodied the country music singer-songwriter. In the museum here, the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, we have what we call our core exhibit that tells the story of country music. And we've called the core exhibit, Sing Me Back Home, A Journey Through Country Music. Of course, Sing Me Back Home is a Merle Haggard song. He connects with the story that we tell in a great and important way.
Now, he was a very versatile songwriter. He could write about songs about broken hearts, like I think about Silver Wings or Today I Started Loving You Again. He also did some stuff that was autobiographical, things like Mama Tried or Hungry Eyes, because he grew up literally in a railroad car turned into a house, in Oklahoma, or in California, rather. And he used that. He used his own life experience to write these songs that are just as poignant today as they were when he first penned them.
Well, you said it yourself, David. That's really true. He drew from his own experience, and he drew from the experience of working men and women in America. I think of a song like Working Man Blues, which is a phrase that people use to describe country music. Working man's blues, or blue collar blues. He really was in touch, much like Woody Guthrie, another, you know, Merle's roots were in Oklahoma, although he grew up in California. Woody Guthrie the same way, and in the same way that Woody Guthrie sang about people of the soil, Merle did as well. And we invited Merle to be our artist in residence. He said, "What do I have to do?" And I said, "Well, one thing is you should not do the same thing on two consecutive nights." He said, "I never do the same thing on two consecutive nights." He was a very versatile performer, and a great musician, and recognized great music.
That is Jay Orr from the Country Music Hall of Fame. He joined us from Nashville. All right, Jay, let me stop.
We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street. 'Cause we like living right and being free.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We're on Twitter, at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Zina Bobdell Rockman. And I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
10 years, 60 countries, nearly 100 women. That was the milestone the U.S. Department of State marked with the 2016 Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award. This year, 14 courageous women were honored. Sarah Hossein is a human rights lawyer who helped draft Bangladesh's first comprehensive legislation on violence against women. Nihal Naj Ali Al-Awlaki is a pioneer in Yemen, where she serves as the Minister of Legal Affairs and the only woman on Yemen's official delegation to peace talks. Deborah Baptiste Estrada has refused bribes and uncovered drug and human trafficking operations in the male-dominated Belize Department of Immigrations. Roger Reg Wathanafanit was subjected to so-called attitude readjustment because her bookstore promotes democracy and freedom of expression in Thailand. Her son was killed by a terrorist, but today Latifa Ibn Ziyatin works with families and young people to promote peace in France. Vicky Ente Tema investigated witch doctors who murdered and sold the body parts of people with albinism. Despite threats against her, she remains an activist in Tanzania. Thelma Aldana started her career as a janitor. Today, she is the Attorney General of Guatemala, where she works to end corruption and gender-based violence. Awadea Mahmoud was jailed for organizing women selling tea in Sudan. Thousands have joined her call for women's economic empowerment. Dr. Nagam Nawzat Hassan was one of the first to respond when ISIL killed, kidnapped, and brutalized Yazidi women and girls. She works to ensure survivors get the care they need. Zuzana Stjavulova stands up for the rights of migrants and refugees in Slovakia. A judge threw Nisha Ayub in prison for being a transgender woman, but she emerged as determined as ever to fight for LGBT rights in Malaysia. After her father was murdered for being an opposition leader, Zhanna Nemtsova committed herself to exposing corruption and supporting families of political prisoners in Russia. Fatimata Embai is the first woman attorney in Mauritania and one of the best. She's taken on very difficult cases to protect human rights and dignity in her country. For her work defending Chinese legal rights, Niu Lan was thrown in prison, where she was beaten so badly she is now paralyzed from the waist down. Yet she continues her work on behalf of others. "These are 14 women of extraordinary courage," said Secretary of State Kerry. "One very clear message out of all this: don't accept the unacceptable or wait for someone else to step up. Act in the name of justice, act in the name of tolerance, act in the name of truth."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.